First, in recent days, there have been stories in the news about the coronavirus testing system in England falling over and a huge backlog of tests across the UK, with people being offered tests hundreds of miles away or not being able to get them at all. Delayed results in Wales and Scotland have been put down to problems with laboratory capacity, which is coordinated at a UK level. Here on More or Less, we're all about the numbers, so we've been looking into what the numbers do and don't show about the reports of chaos in coronavirus testing. Series producer Simon Maben is here. Hello, Simon.
Hello.
So let's go through the process of getting a test. The first question is, can you get one?
Well, the Department of Health and Social Care say our capacity is the highest it has ever been. And they're regularly publishing data on capacity reported by laboratories for the whole of the UK, which seems to back that up. Capacity has gone from around 100,000 a day at the start of May to 375,000 on September the 10th, the latest figure we have.
Well, that seems a lot. However, I am not, as Kay, our editor's mum, puts it, I am not as green as your cabbage looking. There is going to be a but, isn't there?
Yes, Tim, big but. I cannot lie. First of all, you can knock 120,000 off that daily capacity, which is for antibody tests. They don't tell you whether you have COVID now, but whether you have had COVID previously. That's good to know, but what's important when cases are rising are the swab tests that tell you whether you have COVID now. The government's figures show it has capacity to do nearly 250,000 of these tests each day, but we're actually processing only about 200,000 tests a day.
So, according to the data, lab capacity isn't a problem?
Not according to the data, but last week, the data set for testing in hospitals and where there are outbreaks and national swab testing showed a spare capacity of almost 60,000. But at the same time, a director of the NHS Test and Trace programme in England tweeted her heartfelt apologies to people who weren't able to get COVID tests. She said, all of our testing sites have capacity, but that it's our laboratory processing that is the critical pinch point.
But what about that 60,000 spare lab capacity?
You may well ask, Tim, and indeed I have asked the Department of Health about this. They haven't been able to explain the apparent contradiction. That contradiction deepened in recent days, for example, when the Sunday Times reported that leaked documents show large backlogs in laboratories.
Okay, so the government's data says lab capacity is not a problem. Various other credible sources say that it is. So it looks like the data isn't giving us the true picture. What about all the stories about people in London being offered tests in Aberdeen? How far do you have to travel if you can get a test?
Boris Johnson was asked about this at last week's Prime Minister's Questions and said the median journey is under 10 miles if someone has to take a journey to get one. The Health and Social Care Secretary, Matt Hancock, was a bit more specific the following day.
The average distance travelled to a test site is 6.4 miles, and 90% of people who book a test travel 22 miles or less.
Okay, so let's get nerdy for a moment. Boris Johnson said median, which means that the number he quoted isn't going to be skewed by big outliers. Matt Hancock said average. Did he mean the same thing?
Yes, I love it when we get nerdy, Tim. We've been in touch with the Department of Health on this one too. They say Matt Hancock was also talking about the median.
Now, on More or Less, we love all the different averages, the mean, the median and the mode. But Simon, it does strike me that if the government is using the median, that's probably because the mean is bigger, and that would be because some people are driving a really long way for their tests.
They also say that the number is calculated from the distance travelled, which strongly implies it includes only people who actually travelled, not the ones who were offered tests so far away they couldn't get there. We asked if this was the case, but they didn't respond. So it looks like if someone is offered a test hundreds of miles away and decides they can't make that journey, that won't be reflected in the figures.
I think that's crucial, Simon, because we've got no idea how many people are trying and failing to get tests or who don't take a test because the travel's just impossible, especially for people who don't have access to a car. So it seems a fair guess that the government is ignoring such people when it boasts that most people who take a test are making short journeys. Well, thank you, Simon. In the last week, it has become clear that infections are definitely rising. But if there are problems with testing, could this situation actually be worse than we think? I've been talking to Alistair Grant, a professor of ecology at the University of East Anglia, who's been crunching the publicly available data to get some more recent information on when tests are done and when they're processed.
The particular sign of problems that I've noticed is that it's now taking much longer to get test results back. At the end of August, about 70% of test results were returned within 48 hours. That's been dropping steadily since then. And actually, on Monday, it was 10.5% that were returned within those 2 days.
So the delays are hugely increasing. Why does that matter?
Because to trace people's contacts, you need the results as fast as possible. If we're losing at least an extra day in getting the test results, then those contacts can't be traced as effectively. Local authorities can't spot outbreaks that are occurring in their areas. And it just means that more infections can occur during that delay.
So if we've got this backlog, does that mean that we're missing a lot of cases in the numbers that are being reported every evening as the rising case count?
Yes, it will mean that. So there will be a number of positive cases sitting in the backlog, waiting to be processed, waiting to be reported. So on Monday, only 11% of the tests were returned within 48 hours. So there'll be a lot of positive results there that we don't yet know about.
Professor Alistair Grant of the University of East Anglia. So there are some not exactly small steps that are needed to get testing operation up to the job. But Boris Johnson is also looking towards a giant leap.
We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon.
Our plan, this moonshot that I'm describing, will require a giant collaborative effort from government, from business.
Operation Moonshot is the name of the government's new proposal for mass testing in the UK. The idea is that from early next year, 10 million tests a day could provide results in as little as 20 minutes. Now, on More or Less, we often ask, is this a big number? And the answer here is a definitive yes, potentially testing the entire population of the UK on a weekly basis. But since these tests don't actually exist yet, certainly not in a form that's been proven, some people are wondering whether this is really going to happen. But let's say that it does. Would these tests make statistical sense? I've been speaking to John Deeks. He's a professor of biostatistics at the University of Birmingham and co-wrote a letter last week on behalf of the Royal Statistical Society COVID-19 Task Force, which voiced concerns about the moonshot plan. Cheap, rapid tests, he says, are less likely to be accurate.
And that drop in accuracy, it means more people will get, the results will be wrong for more people. And we have to think very carefully is actually what are the consequences of doing that.
One of those errors is a false positive. That's when people who don't have COVID-19 get a positive test result anyway.
These tests have typically had very few false positives. We're looking at figures of 99% above specificity, which means less than 1% of false positive people, 1% of 60,600,000. So there'll be 600,000 people who would get a test result, which was positive, and they don't have COVID. They're not infectious. And so we end up in a position where those people have got to work out what to do. We don't know whether they're one of the people who actually have infectious COVID or whether they're a false positive. Now, that 99%, that 1% figure, they're debated.
Yeah. I mean, could you use it, for example, to target a more sensitive test? So you test 2,000 people, you come up with 200 positives, only one of them actually has the virus. But then you say to those 200 people, OK, you all need to get a proper high-quality PCR test today, and we'll figure out who actually does have the virus and who's good to go. And just try to make sure there's not too much disruption to anyone's lives.
Absolutely. And that's how we run screening programs for cancer. You know, initially, think of breast cancer. A woman will have a mammography examination. Then the women who've got suspicious findings on that will go forward and they'll have another resolver test. They'll have a biopsy done. And out of every 5 or 10 women who have the biopsy done, only one of them actually has cancer. So that's a standard process we use for screening tests. But the figures there were important, 5 or 10. Here we're talking about thousands possibly having to go through this test. It really depends on how much SARS-CoV-2 is around. If we can actually use tests in this situation when the prevalence of the disease is a lot higher, so when we have got outbreaks, we've got places thinking about going down into lockdown, then the benefits will be much more favourable to doing something like this. It makes much more sense.
The other potential problem is false negatives. Current tests miss around a fifth of people with the disease, and if the new rapid tests are even less sensitive, they may miss more. One of the ideas in Operation Moonshot is to test people going into an event, a workplace, or even getting on a flight. But John Deeks says that because of the risk of false negatives, this couldn't replace social distancing measures.
If people are getting a sort of a false sense of confidence in a false negative result, then they may be spreading the virus in ways because they won't be socially distancing, they won't be taking the precautions that they should be. So that, to me, is the biggest risk we have from these false negatives.
Professor John Deeks of Birmingham University. You're listening to More or Less. Last month, a 16-year-old Sudanese boy drowned while attempting to cross the channel between the UK and France.